Chapter 4. The day the Bletchley Park boarders were due to arrive, Beth Finch lost half an hour down the centre of a rose.
"Really, Bethan? I've been calling and calling. How long have you been sniffing that flower?"
"I wasn't sniffing it," Beth thought, but didn't correct her mother. Sniffing a rose was at least normal. Roses smelled nice. Everybody agreed on that. Not everybody looked at a rose and got entranced, not by the scent, but by the pattern of it, the way the petals overlapped like stairs winding inward, inward. She'd run her finger gently along the spiral, moving toward the centre. Only in her mind, there wasn't a centre with stamens. There was just the spiral going on and on toward infinity. It sounded very poetic. What lies at the centre of a rose? But it wasn't the poetry that entranced Beth, or the scent. It was the pattern. And before she knew it, she'd lost half an hour, and her mother was standing there looking cross.
"They'll be here soon, and look at this room."
Mrs. Finch took the bud vase from Beth, placing it on the mantel.
"Wipe down the mirror now. Whoever these girls are, they won't have anything to complain about in this house. Though who knows what kind of girls are boarding away from home anyway, leaving their families for a job."
"There's a war on," Beth murmured. But Mrs. Finch had been on a tear since learning that, being in possession of a spare bedroom with two narrow beds, they would be required to billet two females working at nearby Bletchley Park.
"Don't tell me it's the war. It's flighty girls taking any excuse to bolt out on their families and get into trouble."
Mrs. Finch moved about the room in small, quick motions, straightening the bedside table doily, tweaking the pillowcase. She and Beth had the same mouse-fair hair, the same nearly invisible brows and lashes. But Beth stood round-shouldered and slight, while her mother was imposing, handsome, her bust like a prow.
"What kind of war work are they going to be doing in the middle of Bletchley?"
"Who knows?" The war had sent such ripples through their sleepy little village. Blackout preparations, the call for air raid precautions wardens. Bletchley Park, just down the road, suddenly a hub of mysterious activity. Everyone was curious, especially with women coming to work there as well as men. Women were flinging themselves into all sorts of new ventures these days, according to the papers, joining the FANYs to be nurses or shipping overseas with the Women's Royal Navy. Every time Beth tried to think herself patriotically into one of those roles, she broke out in a cold sweat. She knew she'd be expected to do her bit, but she'd volunteer for something behind the scenes, something even utter idiots couldn't muck up. ARP first aid, maybe, rolling bandages and making tea. Beth was hopeless at most things. She'd been hearing that all her life. And it was true.
"These boarders had better be decent girls," Mrs. Finch was fretting. "What if we end up with two tarts from Wapping?"
"I'm sure not," Beth soothed. She didn't even really know what a tart was. It was her mother's all-purpose condemnation for any female who wore lipstick, smelled of French scent, or read novels. Guiltily, Beth felt the weight of her latest library paperback in her pocket. Vanity Fair.
"Run out to the post office, Bethan."
Mrs. Finch was the only one to call Beth by her full name.
"I can feel one of my headaches coming on,"
massaging her temples.
"Rinse out a cloth for me first, then after the post office, the corner store."
"Yes, Mother." Mrs. Finch patted her shoulder fondly.
"Mother's little helper."
Beth had been hearing that all her life too.
"Bethan is so helpful," Mrs. Finch loved to tell her friends. "What a comfort to think she'll be with me when I'm old." "She might still marry," the widow down the street had said at the last Women's Institute meeting.
Beth had been making tea in the kitchen, but the old woman's whisper carried.
24 years old, that's not utterly hopeless. She hardly has two words to say to anyone. But that doesn't bother most men. Someone might still take her off your hands, Muriel."
"I don't want her taken off my hands," Mrs. Finch had said with that brisk finality that made everything seem preordained.
"At least I'm not a burden," Beth reminded herself.
Most old maids were just a drain on their families. She was a comfort. She had a place. She was Mother's little helper. She was lucky. Tugging at the thin mouse fur plait hanging over one shoulder, Beth went to put the kettle on, then wrung out a cloth in cold water the way her mother liked. Bringing it upstairs, she darted back down and set off on errands. All Beth's siblings had settled out of town when they married,
but not an afternoon passed when Beth wasn't dispatched to post a letter full of maternal advice or a package with a maternal decree. Today, Beth posted a square package to her oldest sister, who'd just delivered a baby. One of Mother's samplers, a wreath of pink roses round the words, "A place for everything and everything in its place." An identical sampler hung over Beth's bed and over the bed of every new baby born to the Finch family. It was never too early, Mother said, to instill proper notions about one's place.
"Have your boarders arrived yet?" the postmaster inquired. "They're peculiar fellows, some of them. Mrs. Bowden at the shoulder of Mutton Inn, she's got a pack of Cambridge dons coming and going at all hours. That won't please your mother, eh?"
He waited for a response, but Beth just nodded, tongue-tied.
"Something not right with that last Finch girl," the postmaster whispered to his clerk as she turned away.
And Beth felt herself flushing crimson. Why couldn't she manage ordinary small talk? It was bad enough being slow-witted, and Beth knew she was. But did she have to be so flustered and awkward as well? Other girls, even the dimmest, seemed able to look people in the eyes when spoken to. It was one thing to be quiet, another thing to freeze in every social gathering like a frightened rabbit. But Beth couldn't help it. She dashed home just in time to lift the kettle off the heat. At least the Finch household had been assured it would be girls boarding, not men. If life were a novel, the mystery boarders would have been dashing young bachelors who would then immediately have vied for Beth's hand, and Beth couldn't imagine anything more terrifying.
"Beth,"
Mr. Finch called absently from his armchair, doing the crossword.
"A freshwater fish of the carp family. 5 letters.
Beth flipped her braid back over one shoulder, laying out the tea things. "Tench."
"I thought bream."
"Bream puts a B into 17 down." Beth reached for the teapot, perfectly able to envision the crossword glimpsed this morning when she'd set the paper by her father's breakfast plate. "And 17 down is codify."
17 down. "To organise into a system, as in a body of law. 6 letters. Right. Codify."
Her dad smiled.
"I don't know how you do that."
My one talent, Beth thought, rueful. She couldn't cook, she couldn't knit, she couldn't make conversation, but by God, she could finish the Sunday crossword in 8 minutes flat without a single mistake.
"Unlucky or ill-fated, 7 letters, Beth's dad began.
But before she could say hapless, footsteps sounded outside, and their boarders were being ushered in with a clatter of suitcases. Mr. Finch held the door. Mrs. Finch shot downstairs like a ferret into a rabbit's burrow. And by the time Beth had taken care of the kettle, introductions were flying. 2 girls, both clearly younger than Beth, entered the spotless kitchen and immediately seemed to take up all the air. Both were brunettes, but that was where the similarity ended. One was dimpled and beautiful and wrapped in a fur-trimmed coat, chattering in a very posh accent. The other was about 6 feet tall, with severe features, perfect red lipstick, and black eyebrows arching like cavalry sabres. Beth's heart sank into her shoes. These girls were just the sort who made her feel clumsy, slow, and, well, hapless.
"So pleased," Mrs. Finch managed to say through pursed lips, "to welcome you to my home."
Her gaze travelled up and down the tall brunette, who returned the stare coolly.
Tart, Beth knew her mother was thinking.
Who knew about the dimply girl? But the one with the eyebrows had without a doubt been classified as a tart before she spoke a single word.
"We are so chuffed to be sent here," the dimply girl gushed, curly lashes working up a breeze of enthusiasm. "One can always tell nice people, can't one? I knew the moment I saw your absolutely topping vegetable garden."
Beth could see her mother thawing at those polished Mayfair vowels.
"We hope you'll be terribly comfortable here," she said, her own accent hitching north. "You'll share the room beside my daughter, first floor. The toilet, the loo, that is, can be found at the bottom of the garden."
"Outside?"
The smaller brunette looked startled. The tall one shot her an amused look.
"You'll get used to it, Osler Kendall. I've never lived in a single flat with a loo inside."
"Oh, shut up, Queen Mab."
Mrs. Finch frowned.
"What is it you young ladies will be doing over at Bletchley Park?"
"Clerical work,"
Osler said breezily.
"Such a snore."
Another frown, but Beth's mother left it for now.
"Lights out at 10. Hot baths every Monday, no dawdling in the tub. We have a telephone.
Proudly, few homes in the village did.
But it is for important calls only. If you'll come upstairs...
The kitchen seemed to echo when the newest additions to the household swept out. Dad, who hadn't sent a word after shaking hands, sat back down with his newspaper. Beth looked at the tea tray, scrubbing her hands up and down her apron.
Bethan, Mrs. Finch swept back into the kitchen. Don't just stand there, take up the tea.
Beth made her escape, glad to be spared the dissecting of the two lodgers she was certain her mother was about to deliver. She paused outside the spare room door, mustering the nerve to knock, and heard the rustling of suitcases being unpacked.
One bath a week?
Mab's voice, crisp and scornful. I call that stingy. I'm not demanding hot water. I don't mind a cold water scrub, but I want clean air however I can get it.
We've a washstand at least. Hello again,
Osler Kendall exclaimed as Beth came in.
Tea, how scrummy. You're a darling.
Beth couldn't remember ever being called a darling.
I'll leave you,
she muttered. But she saw a copy of Vanity Fair unpacked from one of the bags and exclaimed despite herself,
Oh, that's a good one. You've read it.
Beth flushed to the roots of her hair.
Don't tell Mother. Wouldn't dream of it.
Osler plucked a scone off Mrs. Finch's second best china.
No one should tell their mother more than one third of anything they get up to. Curl up with us and have a chin wag.
Without knowing how it happened, Beth found herself perched on the end of Osler's bed. It wasn't much of a conversation. She hardly said two words as the other girls nipped back and forth about Thackeray and whether they should start a literary society. But they both smiled at her periodically, all encouraging glances. Maybe they weren't quite so intimidating after all.
Are not there little chapters in everybody's life? Beth had read in Vanity Fair only that morning.
That seemed to be nothing, and yet affect all the rest of history. Too soon to tell. But perhaps this was, in fact, going to be one of them.
12 days until the royal wedding. November 8th, 1947. Chapter 5. Inside the clock. Three girls and a book. That was how it all began. Or so it seemed to the woman in the asylum, lying in her cell, fighting the cocktail of lethargy that had been pumped into her veins.
Our institution is very progressive, a balding doctor had said when she first arrived, spitting and struggling at Clockwell Sanitarium.
Nearly 3.5 years ago, 6 June, the day of the Normandy invasions, the day that began Europe's liberation and her own imprisonment.
You may have heard horror stories about patients chained to walls, hosed with ice water and so forth. We believe in gentle handling here, mild activity, sedatives to calm the nerves, Miss Liddell.
That is not my name, she had snarled.
He ignored her.
Take your pills like a good girl.
Pills in the morning, pills at night, pills that filled her veins with smoke and her skull with cotton wool. Who cared then about mild activity? There were blunted tools for working in the rose garden around the big grey stone house. There was basket weaving in the common hall. There were novels with missing pages, but very few patients made use of these things. Clockwell's inmates dozed in armchairs or sat outside blinking at the sun, eyes dulled and dreamy from the fog they swallowed every morning in tablet form. Progressive treatment. This place didn't need chains or electrical shocks. It didn't need beatings or ice baths. It was still a killing bottle, an eater of souls. Her first week here, she'd refused to swallow anything the doctors gave her. She got the syringe instead, orderlies holding her down for the needle prick. Afterwards, she stumbled back to her cell. They could call it a room, but any room with locks on only the outside was a cell. Window barred with mesh, bed bolted to the floor, a high ceiling so she couldn't reach the light fixture to hang herself. She thought of hanging herself that first week, but that would have been giving in.
Looking well today, the doctor beamed, popping in on his daily rounds. Still a bit of a cough from that springtime bout of pneumonia, eh, Miss Liddell?
The woman registered under the name Alice Liddell no longer bothered to correct him. She swallowed her pills obediently, then, as soon as he left, went to the plastic basin that served as a chamber pot at night.
Forcing her fingers down her throat, she threw the tablets up in a wash of bile, then reached an indifferent thumb into the mess and ground everything together so the nurses wouldn't guess. She'd learned a few things in 3.5 years. How to vomit up her medicine, how to fool the doctors, how to slide past the orderlies who were spiteful and cultivate the ones who were kind. How to keep her sanity in the midst of madness. Because it would be easy, so easy, to go authentically mad here. Not me, thought the woman from Bletchley Park. She might have been sitting grey-faced and coughing in a madhouse cell, but she had not always been this. I will survive. I will get out. Not that it would be easy. The walls circling Clockwell were high and barbed. She'd walked them 1,000 times. Every entrance, the big gates at the front, the smaller access doors used by the grounds crew, was locked, the keys kept under guard. And even if she could get past that wall, the nearest town was miles away across barren Yorkshire moors. A slippered woman in an institutional smock stood no chance. She'd merely wander the gorse until she was recaptured. She'd known from her second week here that if she was to get out, she would need help. She'd smuggled her ciphered messages out last week. 2 desperate missives launched into the void like messages in bottles, sent to 2 women who had no reason to help her. They betrayed me, the thought whispered. You betrayed them, the whisper said back. Had they received the letters yet? If they had, would they listen? London. Osler stood in her lace slip and robe, looking at the message that had thrown such a spanner into her day. The echo of the telephone's furious slam on the other end of the line in Yorkshire still reverberated, along with her former friend's choked voice. Go to hell, Osler Kendall. A clock ticked in the corner, and a blue satin dress slid off the heap on the bed. What she would wear to watch Princess Elizabeth marry her own former boyfriend now seemed the stupidest bit of bobbery in the world. Osler flung down the cipher message, and sunlight bounced green sparks across the lines of code, reflected off the big emerald ring her fiancé had put on her left hand 4 months ago. Any other woman, Osler reflected, would have run to her husband-to-be if she got menacing letters from a madhouse inmate. It was the sort of thing fiancés liked to know if the women they loved were being threatened by lunatics. But Osler knew she was not going to tell a soul. A few years at Bletchley Park turned any woman into a real clam. Osler sometimes wondered how many women there were in Britain like her, lying to their families all day, every day, about what they'd done in the war. Never once saying the words, I may just be a housewife now, but I used to break German ciphers in Hut 6. Or, I may look like a brainless socialite, but I translated naval orders in Hut 4. So many women. By the end of the war in Europe, Bletchley Park and its outstations had 4 women to every man. Or so it seemed when he saw the swarm of victory-rolled hair and utility frocks come spilling out at shift change. Where were all those women now? How many men who had fought in the war now sat reading their morning newspapers without realizing the woman sitting across the jam pots from them had fought too? Maybe the ladies of BP hadn't faced bullets or bombs, but they'd fought. Oh yes, they'd fought. And now they were labelled simply housewives or schoolteachers or silly debs. And they probably bit their tongues and hid their wounds, just like Osler. Because the ladies of BP had certainly taken their share of war wounds. The woman who had sent Osler the Visionaire Square wasn't the only one to crock up and end in a madhouse, gibbering under the strain. Get me out of here, the ciphered message read. You owe me. The cipher message said a lot of other things, too. The telephone shrieked, and Osler nearly jumped out of her skin. She snatched up the handset. Did you change your mind about meeting? It surprised her, the thrum of relief that went through her. No love lost between herself and her old friend. But if she had someone to face this problem with...
Meeting whom, Miss Kendall?
The voice was male, insinuating, oilier than Brill Cream on a cheapside shoe salesman.
Where are you off to? Private rendezvous with the royal fiancé, perhaps?
Osler straightened, jangling nerves subsiding in a rush of straightforward loathing.
I don't remember which scandal rag you write for, but stop talking slush and bugger off.
She banged down the handset. The sheet sniffers had been haunting her doorstep ever since the royal engagement had been announced. It didn't matter that there wasn't anything to find. They wanted dirt. 1 hour ago, she'd been looking for any excuse to get away from them, from the wedding hysteria, out of London altogether. She heard the furious voice through the telephone again.
Go to El, Osler Kendall.
Oh, plug it, Osler said aloud, making a sudden decision. I'm coming to talk to you, whether you like it or not. Because nothing about the woman in the madhouse could be discussed by telephone, and the only person she could talk to about it lived in York now, a long, long way from London. Two birds, one stone.
7 years ago. June, 1940. Chapter 6.
Dear Philip, I work in a blinking madhouse, Osler imagined scribbling to her fair-haired prince. Not that she could give him details about her new job in those letters posted to Philip's ship, but she'd got into the habit of talking to him in her head, spinning the straw of daily life into entertaining gold anecdotes. It's a small madhouse tucked inside a larger one. The large one is Bletchley Park, the small one is Hut 4. Hut 4 simply defies description. She'd turned up for her first shift promptly at 9 the morning after signing the Official Secrets Act, thrilled to her bones to be doing something more important than pot-riveting seams. All she wanted in this world was to prove herself, prove once and for all that a Mayfair giggler who'd curtsied to the king in pearls and plumes could poke her up in wartime and serve as well as anyone else, could do something important even. Well, banging hurricanes together might have been useful, but this was in a different class. Osler had already vowed she'd stick it out here, no matter how hard it was. She was only sorry she and Mab wouldn't be working together. Dear Philip, the girl I'm billeted with is simply divine, and I forbid you to ever meet her, because you would probably fall in love on the spot, and then I would have to hate her. Not you. You wouldn't be able to help yourself. Mab would wing a superb eyebrow at you, and that would be that. But I can't afford to hate her, because it's clear I will need allies if I am to survive in the house of the dread Mrs. Finch. More about her later. Osler and Mab had sauntered to the gates of Bletchley Park in the bright June morning, where Mab was shunted to Hut 6 and Osler to Hut 4. Well then. Mab perched her little chip hat at an aggressively chic angle. Show me just one eligible bachelor, Hut 6, and we'll get along fine. Osler hoped Mab was met by a more appetizing specimen than the fellow who answered her own knock. A stocky, balding fellow in a Fair Isle jumper.
German Naval Section,
he greeted Osler as she stepped into the long, green-painted building, squatting next to the mansion like a frog.
You've got the German, then?
You mean, have I got a German tucked in my handbag? Osler quipped. Afraid not, darling. He looked blank. She sighed, spouting some schiller in her impeccable Hochdeutsch. He waved for her to stop.
Good, good. You'll assist with the registration, the WT sorting, the teleprinted traffic.
He whisked her inside the hut and showed her through. Two large rooms separated by a door, a small room at the end, another little room after that, which had been subdivided even smaller. Long tables heaped with papers and atlases, swivel chairs, pigeonholes, green steel filing cabinets. It was stiflingly hot, the men in shirt sleeves, while the women patted perspiring faces with handkerchiefs. With a distracted,
have a go,
he passed Osler over to a motherly middle-aged woman who took in the new arrival's evident confusion with a smile.
It wouldn't be any clearer if he tried to explain. These Oxbridge types are hopeless at explaining anything.
Dear Philip, my entire introduction to the world of code-breaking was, have a go. The middle-aged woman introduced herself as Miss Senyard and made introductions to the others. A few girls like Osler, all Mayfair diction and pearls. A few girls with universities stamped all over them, all efficient and friendly as they showed the new girl the ropes. Some were sorting wireless telegraphy forms. Some were collecting unknown German naval codes and identifying call signs and frequencies with slashes of a pencil. Osler received a towering stack of loose papers and a punching machine.
Take these signals and bind them up properly, dear. It's the early naval enigma traffic. Poor Mr. Birch's cupboards are positively overflowing, and we've got to get it filed.
Osler studied a sheet, a report of some kind, translated German, broken and patchy, as if parts of the sentence hadn't come through.
Why is this in German and not that?
She asked the girl next to her, nodding at the cards with their keys and call signs, much of it gibberish.
This is the undeciphered stuff. We log it, register it, then it goes out to the naval section boffins to be broken. The boffins are the brainy ones. Admiringly. Who knows what they do or how they do it? But the undeciphered stuff comes back to us broken into readable German.
Oh. That was where the important work was done then.
Osler wrestled with the punching machine, fighting a sense of deflation. Punching holes to bind papers together and stick them in cupboards. Was this really the best use of her language skills? Had she managed yet again to land in a place where the real work was being done by someone else? Not that she was going to get in a wax about needing to be important. She just wanted to be used well.
Never mind that, she scolded herself. It's all important, and it's only your first day.
What do we do with all these reports and signals then, once they come back broken into German?
It's all translated, logged, analysed. Miss Senyard's box files have copies of every German naval and naval air signal. Periodically we get someone in a tearing hurry, requesting a copy of this report or that one. And we send the raw decrypts to the Admiralty, as well as reporting by telephone. We've got a direct line. Hinsley rings since he's liaison. Then they give him the brush off and he goes about muttering insults for the next hour.
Why do they brush him off?
Would you believe it if some reedy Cambridge student from the middle of nowhere called to tell you where the U-boat wolf packs were? And when you asked how that information was obtained, his reply was, you don't need to know.
Dear Philip, the Admiralty currently making decisions for your beloved Navy lurches along on shrugs, shoeboxes, and ignorance. Is this entire war run by idiots? That will explain why we're on the verge of being invaded. Not that she ever would have written Philip anything so defeatist. Osler kept her letters cheerful. The last thing a man at war needed was gloom from the home front. But to herself, in her own head, she didn't mind being pessimistic. It got difficult keeping your chin up, all the while imagining what London would look like once the Jerrys had nailed German street names over the signs to Piccadilly and St. John's Wood. It could happen. Not that anyone said it, but everyone was in a pelter worrying that it would happen. The Americans weren't coming to the rescue. Most of Europe had fallen. England was next. That was the bleak reality.
I might see the news here first, Osler thought, reaching for a new report. She might know before anyone else in the country, before Churchill, before the King, when they were being invaded, because the next decoded German report might be orders for a pack of destroyers to sail for Dover. Just because the brainy boys here could decode what the Nazis said to each other, that didn't mean they could stop it.
I don't know what you're doing in there, Osler thought to the boffins breaking codes for the U-boat packs that hunted ships like Phillips. But do it faster. That made her wonder.
If this is naval section, can we look up our own ships in the decrypted reports? See if the Germans have flagged them in their radio traffic?
Like HMS Kent, currently bearing a certain fair-haired royal midshipman toward Bombay.
Or are we not allowed to ask about such things?
The orders had been no talking to anyone outside Bletchley, and no talking to anyone outside or inside about one's work. But those instructions still left quite a few grey areas. Osler had no intention of breaking the Official Secrets Act on her very first day.
Dear Philip, I'm going to be hanged for treason, or possibly shot by firing squad.
We all talk in hut, the reassuring answer came. It's all right, as long as everything you learn stays in hut. You can try looking up a ship if you've got a fellow on board, but you can't pass on anything you find to his mum.
That wouldn't be a problem, Osler reflected. Philip never mentioned his mother. He'd talk about his sisters, the ones who had married Nazis, and to whom he could no longer write. He'd talk about the sister who died in a plane crash with her entire family a few years ago. He'd even mention his long-estranged father, but never his mother.
So, your shipboard friend?
A nudge.
Fiancé?
Oh, just a boyfriend,
Osler murmured, banging away at the punching machine. She'd had a boyfriend since she was 16, casual crushes conducted over late-night dancing, and the occasional kiss in the back of a taxi. Nothing serious. Philip had gone to sea in February. They'd barely known each other 6 weeks, dancing at the Café de Paris when Osler got a night off from the hurricane factory. Long evenings when he'd drive to her shared digs and lie with his head in her lap as they listened to gramophone records and chatted the night away.
Are you falling for your handsome prince? Sally Norton teased one evening after Philip ambled out after midnight.
He's not my prince, Osler retorted.
He's looking for a girl to splash out with before going to war, that's all. For me, he's just another boyfriend.
Except Philip was the only one who made her bones burn. The first kisses of her life that felt dangerous. The last night before he'd shipped out, he'd gripped her hand tighter than usual and said abruptly,
"Write to me, Oz. If you do, I'll write to you. I haven't anyone to write to, really."
"I'll write," Ozla had said. No jokes, no teasing. He leaned in for another of those long, heated doorstep kisses, the ones that went on, his hands moving across her back, her fingers deep in his hair. Before he pulled away, he pressed something into her hand and then leaned down and crushed his lips to her folded fingers for a long moment.
"So long, princess."
She'd opened her hand and seen the cool glitter of his naval insignia, like a little jeweled pin. As she fastened it to her lapel like a brooch, she warned herself again, careful. Her mother spent all her time making a mug of herself over unsuitable men, and Ozla was determined to be the apple who fell a long way from the tree. Someone came over, a scholarly type in an unraveling jumper, interrupting Osla's musings.
"Give me a hand, girls. I need this report."
And he rattled off a series of numbers.
"Make him out a copy, dear," Miss Senyard directed, pulling the report, and Ozla obeyed as the man nearly danced on his toes with impatience.
Ozla remembered Redhead Giles saying the park was stuffed with Oxford dons and Cambridge chess champions, and wondered where he worked, if he was one of the brainy ones working the middle stage of this process, taking the raw gibberish from German radio traffic, the stuff they were registering and logging, and breaking it apart until it was something that could be read, translated, analysed, and filed in sections like this one.
"Thanks."
The man flew off with his copied report, leaving Ozla feeling both pleased and deflated, and she went back to binding and filing signals. She had absolutely no idea what had just happened, why that one report had been needed, and she never would know. That was all right. It was important to someone, and she'd played her part. But there wasn't any doubt this job was a lot simpler than she'd hoped for. The pace might have been frenetic, but anyone with a teaspoon of brains and a little attention to detail could bind and file.
"Dear Philip, am I an ungrateful cow if I've gone from wishing I could do more for the war than bang sheets of dural to wishing I could do more for the war than wield a punching machine? My job's a yawn, so let's hear about yours," Ozla told her billet mate that night.
Mab had just slipped in from the outdoor loo, and Ozla lay across her narrow bed in slip and knickers, trying to get in a chapter of Vanity Fair before lights out.
"Day one. How was it?"
"Not bad."
Mab stripped out of the robe she'd donned to go downstairs, standing in her own slip and knickers.
"Can't say much more than that, can I? All this secrecy. Are we even allowed to ask each other how's work?"
Mab's slip was nylon and very worn. Ozla, in peach silk with French lace inserts, remembered the girls of her deb season tittering about the poor girls, by which they meant the ones who wore the same frock twice in 1 week. She'd watched Mab unpack exactly 4 dresses from her suitcase into their shared wardrobe, all perfectly pressed, and felt self-conscious unpacking more than 4 of her own.
"Mind you," Mab went on, picking up her hairbrush, "I don't think our nosy landlady cares about secrecy. Did you see her pursing her lips over supper when we wouldn't answer every question? And good luck to anyone else trying to get a word in."
Ozla had tried to ask the washed-out daughter a thing or two, but the poor mouse hadn't uttered a peep around her mother's peppering questions. Ozla still wasn't sure if the girl's name was Beth or Bess. She wondered if she could get by with darling through the entire war.
"I'll tell you one thing about my hut."
Mab's hair crackled as she stroked the brush vigorously through it.
"It's got my future husband in it somewhere. I've never seen so many eligible bachelors in my life."
"Oh, glamour boys."
"I said eligible, not glamorous."
Mab gave that grin of hers, the one that cracked the cool, guarded expression on her rather severe face, and made her look like a pirate who had spotted a Spanish treasure galleon on the horizon.
HMS Queen Mab, out to chase and board the unsuspecting bachelors of Bletchley Park, thought Ozla.
"Anyone in your hut catch your eye?"
"Oh, I'm not looking for a fellow," Ozla said airily. "Dear Philip, it's a madhouse, and maybe my job's a touch undemanding, but I think I like it here." Chapter 7. June 1940. If Bletchley Park had a motto, Mab thought, it would be, "You dinna need to know."
"Are the other huts set up like this one?" Mab asked as she was whisked through the central corridor of Hut 6.
"You dinna need to know," said her new supervisor, a middle-aged woman with a crisp Scottish voice. "You're assigned to the decoding room."
And she ushered Mab into a box of a place, all lino and blackout curtains, filing cabinets and wooden trestle tables. But it was the two machines that made Mab stare. Awkward, composite things, bristling with three rows of keys, a set of wheels on one side, big spools of tape somehow attached. Mab thought they looked like a cross between a typewriter, a shop till, and a telephone switchboard. A woman sat hammering at one of the machines, hunched like Quasimodo. The Hunchback of Notre Dame had been number 34 on 100 classic literary works for the well-read lady.
"Miss Chert, is it?"
The Scotswoman led Mab to the unoccupied machine.
"Most of our girls are Newham College or Girton College. Where did you graduate?"
"Claiborne secretarial course, top of my class."
Take that, Girton College. Mab wasn't going to be embarrassed by her lack of schooling any more than she was going to be embarrassed by her nylon underwear in the face of Osler's French lace slips.
"I suppose it doesn't matter,"
the Scotswoman said dubiously.
"This is your Tapex machine. It's mocked up to decipher the encrypted messages the Germans send by radio to their offices in the field. Each service of the German armed forces sends those messages using a service-specific key over their own wireless networks, and the settings of that key are changed daily. Our listening stations across Britain and abroad intercept those messages, transcribe them, and send them to BP. By the time they make their way to the decoding room, they're given to you as coded messages."
She held up one finger.
"You will be given settings, a different setting for each key."
A second finger.
"You will align your machine to those settings."
A third finger.
"And you will punch the coded messages into the machine so they can be decoded into German. Do you understand?"
"Not really."
"Yes, of course. You'll get an hour at noon for dinner, and there is a toilet block outside. This hut works around the clock, Miss Chert. 14 days on the 9 to 4, then 14 days on the 4 to midnight, then 12 days on the midnight to 9.
The Scotswoman bustled off to some other compartment of Hut 6. The girl at the other Typex machine, snail-hunched in a pebbly jumper, slid a stack of papers over as Mab took her seat.
"That's the rest of the day's read," she said without preamble. "Bit late today. The boys in Hut 3 get titchy if we haven't got it for them by breakfast. Here's the setting."
She showed Mab how to fix up her Typex machine for decoding red traffic, the order for the three wheels, then something she called the Ringstellung, rattling off numbers that each equated to a letter of the alphabet. Mab followed along, head swimming.
"Then a check to be sure the setup's correct. Set each of your three wheels to A and type out a keyboard alphabet. If it corresponds exactly letter for letter, you're ready to start. See?"
"Not really."
"Yes, of course. Now you just bang through each message as fast as you can,"
indicating the big spools of tape attached to the Typex.
"Type in the encrypted stuff, and it'll feed out in plain text letters. If it looks like German, pass it on. If it looks like rubbish, put it aside, and one of the more experienced girls will take a second crack at it."
"I don't speak German."
"You don't have to. Just recognize it. The tricky part is looking past the five-letter clumps everything is sorted into, but you'll get the knack."
Mab stared at the stack.
"We'll never get through all of this. Up to 1,000 messages a day in red since France was overrun," the girl said,
which made Mab feel no more confident. Slowly, she picked up the first message. Blocks of letters. ACDOU. LMNRS. TDOPS. On like that for a whole page. Mab looked at her partner, hunched over her own identical sheet of nonsensical five-letter groups, and wondered what Lucy was doing back home.
"I shouldn't have left you for this, Luce. You're alone with Mum in a city that's going to get bombed any day, and I'm stuck in a hut typing ruddy nonsense."
But there wasn't any use whining about it, so Mab squared her shoulders, typed a few letter groups that the other girl had said with the introduction and signatory, then began on the main message.
ACDOULMNRSTDOPSFCQPNYHXPZ.
To her surprise, the letters came out different. KEINEBESONDERENERIGNISSE.
Kina Besondren Eregnisse, said the girl to Mab's left. You'll see that one now and then. I know a bit of German by now. It means no special developments.
Mab stared at the message. No special developments. So this message wasn't too important then. Or maybe it was. Maybe it came from an area where developments were expected. Maybe that was critical news. She kept typing, and the machine kept spitting out five-letter clumps of German until the end. What do we do with these when...
Write the final position of the wheels under the message setting, sign it, stick the original decrypt to it, and put it in that tray. Keep going through your stack. Things will get slow later, but we're in a rush now to get all the red decoded.
What is red, if I can ask?
Red's the key for German Air Force communications.
Why red? Mab asked, fascinated.
A shrug.
It was the coloured pencil the Boffins were using when they were first figuring out how to crack it. We've also got green, blue, yellow. All different keys for different traffic.
Who are the Boffins?
The brainy boys who make the initial breaks. They work out the setting for each cipher. If they didn't, we wouldn't know how to set our machines to decode all the messages.
Patting the Typix's three wheels.
The Jerrys change the settings every day, so every night shift as midnight ticks over, the Boffins start all over again, figuring out the new setting for every single key.
How?
Who knows? However they do it, we decode it, and then it moves off to Hut 3 for translating and analysis.
Mab supposed that was what the German-speaking girls like Osla did. Take this mess of German in five-letter blocks and turn it into nice, legible English reports. Air Force communications, Army communications, intercepted at distant listening stations, whatever those were. Mab imagined men in headphones listening in on German radio channels, jotting Morse madly. Then whirled through the various Bletchley huts so university boys could crack them open, so typing pool girls like Mab could decode them, so bilingual girls like Osla could translate them. Like a conveyor belt in a factory.
We're reading your post, Mab thought, picking up the next report.
Take that, Herr Hitler.
She hammered another message out on the Typex, taped and processed it, reached for another. By noon, she had the knack of scanning those five-letter clumps, seeing which were rubbish and which were German. Her back hurt from curling into a C. Her fingers were sore from hammering the stiff keys. But she was smiling.
Look at me, she thought. Mabel from Shoreditch, decoding ruddy Nazi intelligence.
Mum would never have believed it, even if Mab had been able to tell her. It was two more days before Mab got a look at the men her seatmate called the Boffins.
This box of pencils and supplies is for the boys in the next room. Miss Chert, take it over.
Mab obeyed, dying for a look at the other denizens of Hut 6. Stalky, red-haired Giles Talbot answered her knock.
Oh, it's you, divinely tall goddess.
Tennyson, she said, pleased to recognise the quote. He grinned up at her.
Don't tell me you ended up in our Ring of the Inferno, Miss Chert.
Decoding room, Mab answered, reflecting that it was strange to see Giles in trousers, not just white legs stuck all over with duckweed.
Do make it Mab, not Miss Chert.
If you'll make it Giles, oh fairy queen.
Spencer! And yes, I will.
Mab handed the box of supplies over, looking around. Another stuffy room crammed with men hunched over desks, every surface heaped with scraps of paper, pencil stubs, and jumbled strips of letters. The fog of concentration in the room was as thick as the fog of cigarette smoke as the men muttered and scribbled. They looked like they were at the absolute end of their tether, like they'd fallen off another planet. But Mab would eat her hat if these weren't the brainy boys who cracked the keys. And she'd bet they were all Cambridge or Oxford boys too. Her hopes rose. University degrees weren't exactly thick on the ground in Shoreditch. Of course, a good university didn't mean a good man. Mab, of all people, knew that. She shoved that particular memory away before it could curdle her stomach into an icy ball. Down, down, bloody go away. And smiled at the roomful of potential husbands. Just let one of you be nice as well as educated and gentlemanly,
and I will make you the best bloody wife you ever dreamed of.
What's a girl to do for fun round here when shift's over? Mab asked Giles with a dazzling smile.
There are more recreation clubs here than you can shake a stick at. Highland dancing, chess. I'm not one for reels or game boards. Do you like books?
Osler Kendall and I are starting a literary society.
Love a good yarn. I'm your man.
Maybe you are, thought Mab, who had made up the literary society on the spot. Not the lure she'd have used for the lads back home, but in this crowd.
First meeting Sunday next. Bring the boys.
She aimed another smile around the room and went back to her Typex.
I'm knackered, Osler groaned when Sunday next finally arrived. The work's not hard, but every day it feels like the pace doubles. My heart too.
If it had been peacetime, the frenetic rate of the work would have given Mab thoughts of transferring elsewhere. But with a war on, all you could do was grit your teeth. She reached up to fluff her hair.
Forget the work for a night. It's time for fun.
The Shoulder of Mutton Inn was to host the first meeting of the Bletchley Park Literary Society. Giles said their fish and chips weren't to be missed, and after Mrs. Finch's leaden stews, fish and chips sounded like heaven.
I nabbed a fellow for tonight's meeting, by the way, just for you.
Osler, too, sounded like she was determinedly putting her very long week behind her, along with the war and everything else unpleasant.
He's hot eight, simply scrumptious. The tallest thing you've ever seen, positively made for a 6-foot wife. You won't be stuck in flats your entire life.
I don't mind men who are shorter than me. I mind men who are touchy about being shorter than me.
What about Giles, then? He's too much the jester to get in a wax about anything, much less tall women.
Something tells me he's the bachelor type. We'll see after tonight.
Mab grinned.
The nice thing about meeting men here is that they can't drone about what they do. They actually have to talk about books or the weather,
or, God forbid, ask you a question or two about yourself.
Osler grinned back, swinging her crocodile handbag.
Are you heading Shea Finch first to change?
Yes. Red print frock.
You'll look slap up. I don't think I'll bother changing. Just nip straight there all scruffy and ink-stained, and no one will look at me when you swan in.
Osler could roll in a gusser and still everyone would look at her, Mab thought. Even at the end of a very long shift, she looked rumpled and adorable, rather than frazzled and exhausted. It should have been easy to resent Osler, but Mab couldn't quite manage it. How could you resent a girl who scouted men over 6 feet tall for another girl's husband pool?
There you are, Mrs. Finch greeted Mab as she came into the scrubbed kitchen. Working on a Sunday, I see. No rest when there's a war on, Mrs. F.
Mab tried to slide past, but Mrs. Finch blocked her way.
Now, why won't you just give us a hint what you do? She said with a little laugh. What do you all get up to behind those gates? My goodness, really, it's too boring to talk about. You can trust me.
Mrs. Finch was clearly not giving up. Her voice was cozy, but her eyes had a certain gleam.
Just a hint. I'll dole you a bit extra from the sugar ration.
No, thank you, Mab said coldly.
Such a careful one.
Mrs. Finch patted her arm, gleam in the eye hardening, but she moved out of the way. Mab rolled her eyes at the retreating back, not realizing until she heard the nearly inaudible voice that Mrs. Finch's colourless daughter was sitting in the corner of the kitchen, shelling peas.
You should just tell Mother something. She won't be satisfied till she knows.
Mab looked at the other girl. Hardly a girl. She was 24, and she volunteered with the women's voluntary services when she wasn't being run off her feet by her mother. But she gave the impression of a girl, with that colourless skin that showed every wash of emotion, and those eyes that never rose from the floor. Mab couldn't help a flash of annoyance.
I'm not here to satisfy your mother's curiosity, Bess.
The girl flushed dull red.
Beth,
she said almost inaudibly. She sat, shoulders rounded, like a puppy whose cringing practically invited a certain kind of person to give a good kick. As she carried the shelled peas to the counter, Mab could see the outline of a paperback hidden in her skirt pocket.
Done with Vanity Fair yet?
Beth flinched, fiddling with her plait's stringy ends.
You didn't tell Mother, did you?
Mab swallowed some less than polite words. A woman of 24 should not be apologizing to her mother about a library habit.
Grow a spine, Mab wanted to say,
While you're at it, put a lemon rinse on that hair and try looking people in the eye.
If there was anything Mab couldn't stand, it was limp women. The women in her own family were hardly perfect. In fact, most of them were flint-hard cows, but at least they weren't limp.
Beth sat back down at the kitchen table. She'd probably sit there the rest of the night until her mother told her to go to bed.
"Get your coat, Beth," Mab heard herself saying.
What?
"Get your coat while I change. You're coming to the first meeting of the Bletchley Park Literary Society."
Chapter 8. The shoulder of mutton reared its thatched head at Buckingham and Newton Roads, the bar cosy and bright, the private sitting room low-beamed and inviting. It was everything Beth feared about social gatherings: tight quarters, loud noises, cigarette smoke, fast conversation, strange people, and men. Anxiety choked her throat, and she couldn't stop fiddling with the end of her plait like it was a lifeline.
"You billet here, Giles?" someone was asking the lanky red-haired man. "Blimey, you got lucky. Don't I know it. Mrs. Bowden's a gem. Not much bothered by rationing. I swear she's queen of the local black market. We've got the private room. Get your drinks."
Beth found herself clutching a sherry she didn't dare sip. What if her mother smelled liquor on her breath?
"Swig that down," Mab advised.
What?
Beth was eyeing the group piling around the table. Osler, laughing as an army lieutenant lit her cigarette. Several gangling academic sorts gawping at Mab like puppies. Red-haired Giles and a truly massive black-haired man who had to duck under the rafter. All of them worked at the mysterious Bletchley Park. So what was Beth doing here? She didn't know what to make of these people. Some looked so shabby in their patched tweeds that her mother might have taken them for tramps, but they talked in such over-educated drawls she could hardly understand a word they said.
"Relax," Mab said.
She had a glass of beer, and she'd thrown one leg over the other in casually elegant fashion. "We're only here to talk books."
"I shouldn't be here," Beth whispered. "It's a literary society, not a bordello. I can't stay."
Beth set her sherry down.
"My mother will pitch a fit."
"So?
It's her house, her rules, and I..."
"It's your house too, and really it's your father's house."
Beth's words dried up. Impossible to explain how slight a presence her father really was in the Finch household. He never put his foot down. He wasn't that kind of husband, that kind of father. The finest of men, Beth's mother always said smugly when other women in the village complained of overbearing husbands.
"I can't stay," Beth repeated.
"The greatest tyrants over women are women," Mab quoted. "Have you read that far in Vanity Fair?"
She arched one brow, then addressed the men across the table.
"So, shall we vote on a book every month? How shall we tally up?"
"Popular vote,"
one of the skinny academics was saying.
"Or the ladies will have us all reading romantic tosh."
"Romantic tosh?" Osler demanded, squashing in on Beth's left. "The last thing I read was Vanity Fair."
"That's about girls, isn't it?"
Giles objected.
"It's written by a man, so that's all right," Mab said tartly. "Why do you men get the swithers if you have to read anything written by a female?" Osler wondered. "Aren't we a century out from poor Charlotte Bronte signing herself Currer Bell to get published?"
Fish and chips arrived, leaking grease. Beth didn't dare touch hers any more than the sherry. Nice girls did not eat in public houses. Nice girls did not smoke or drink or argue with men. Osler's a nice girl, Beth thought, marshalling arguments for later. Nothing Mab did was going to find approval with Mrs. Finch, but Osler was another story. She's been presented at court. You can't say she isn't a lady, Mother. And here Osler was, crunching up chunks of fried cod, swilling sherry, and arguing with Giles about Lewis Carroll's Through the Looking Glass, obviously having a grand time. Somehow Beth didn't think that argument was going to weigh much with her mother either. Mrs. Finch wasn't going to care about anything except that Beth had gone out, without permission.
"I vote for Conan Doyle,"
the huge, dark-haired man on Beth's right was saying.
"Who doesn't like Sherlock Holmes? You've already read everything Doyle ever wrote, Harry."
He didn't look like a Harry, Beth thought, trying not to stare at the man. He wasn't just enormous, nearly a head taller even than Mab. Broad enough he'd nearly turned sideways through the door. But he was black-haired and swarthy, almost dark-skinned. Beth could imagine the village ladies whispering, "Is he a wog or an eye tie?"
but he didn't sound like a foreigner. He had exactly the same university drawl as the rest.
"Maltese, Arab, and Egyptian," he said, catching Beth's eye.
She flinched. "What?"
"My father's family is originally from Malta. My mother was born to an Egyptian diplomat and the daughter of a banker from Baghdad."
He grinned.
"Don't be embarrassed. Everyone wants to know. I'm Harry Zarb, by the way."
"You speak English very well," she managed to reply.
"Well, my branch of the family's been London-based for 3 generations. I was baptized Church of England, then went through King's College in Cambridge like my father and grandfather before me. So, be rather embarrassing if I didn't speak English well."
I'm so sorry," Beth whispered, mortified.
"Look like me and everyone thinks you were born in a tent on a sand dune."
He shrugged, but Beth was too embarrassed to answer. She let the talk pass over her head, reaching for the newspaper abandoned at the next table and turning for the crossword. It was half obliterated by grease stains, but she fell into it gratefully, doing it up with a pencil stub.
"You went through that like a derby winner,"
Osler laughed. But Beth just stared down at her feet. Would this night never be over? One look at her mother, sitting at the kitchen table with her Bible, 2 bright spots of colour flaring in her cheeks, and Beth shriveled down to her bones.
"Now, you mustn't put yourself in a pucker, Mrs. F,"
Osler attempted with her winning smile as they filed into the kitchen.
"It's not Beth's fault. We dragged her out," Mab added. "Really?
Hadn't you better get to bed, girls?"
Mrs. Finch looked at the kitchen clock.
"Lights out in 20.
There wasn't anything the other two could do but go upstairs. Mrs. Finch's nose twitched at the smells of cigarette smoke, beer, sherry.
"I'm sorry, Mother,"
Beth began. But that was all she managed to say as her mother seized her arm.
"The whole village will be talking. Did you think about that?"
Mrs. Finch didn't shout. She spoke sorrowfully. That made it so much worse.
"The ingratitude, Bethan. The disgrace."
She held out her Bible, open to Deuteronomy.
"If any man has a stubborn and rebellious son who will not obey his father or his mother, and when they chastise him, he will not even listen to them. Mother, did you think that didn't apply to daughters? They shall say to the elders of the city, 'This daughter of ours is stubborn and rebellious. She will not obey us. She is a glutton and a drunkard. I didn't drink a drop.'"
Mrs. Finch shook her head sadly, holding out the Bible. Beth took the heavy book and held it straight out, tear-blurred eyes fixed on the page of Deuteronomy. The longest she'd ever had to hold it up was 30 agonizing minutes. Surely, it being so late, Mother wouldn't...
"You've disappointed me, Bethan."
A hard pinch to the inside of Beth's arm as the Bible began to droop. Then the gentle disapproval flowed on. Beth had behaved shamefully. She had disgraced her mother, who took care of her when she was too slow-witted and head in the sky to look after herself. Beth was lucky she'd never marry and have children, so she'd never know how they broke your heart. 15 minutes later, Beth was hiccuping with sobs, tears dripping off her hot cheeks, arms shaking and burning with the effort to keep the book level with her eyes.
"Of course I forgive you, Bethan. You may lower the Bible."
A pat instead of a pinch to Beth's arm as she dropped the book.
"This is bringing on one of my headaches."
Beth flew teary-eyed for a cold cloth, a footstool. It was half an hour before she was allowed to go to bed. Her arms hung loose as noodles, muscles aflame. Finally daring to massage the tender flesh inside her elbow, Mrs. Finch had strong fingers. They pinched so hard. Beth reached the first landing and heard voices through Osler and Mab's door.
"Poor Beth,"
Osler was saying. "She could grow a spine," Mab responded tartly. "If my mother went at me like that at my age, I'd dish it right back."
"She's not you, Queen Mab. I've never seen anybody so perfectly, hopelessly Fanny Price in my life."
Mab made an inquiring noise.
"You know, the dishrag heroine in Mansfield Park, who goes about looking like a dog's dinner and raining on everyone's fun. Don't tell me you haven't read Austen."
Beth didn't wait to hear any more. Tears sliding from her eyes all over again, cheeks burning with dull humiliation, she stumbled into her bedroom. How idiotic, how pathetic, thinking that because the Bletchley Park girls threw her a few nice words like a bone to a dog, they actually liked her in the slightest. Even more idiotic and pathetic to think that just because the red brick mansion down the road had become a hive of wartime activity, life would change. Nothing for Beth was going to change. Ever.
Chapter 9. June rolled into July, and Osler was dying for a project. Work in German naval section might have carried on at a frenetic pace, but it was about as intellectually taxing as noughts and crosses. I need a challenge, Osler thought, yawning as she helped Miss Senyard notate unknown German codes to be passed up the ladder for identification. Or at least I will when I'm back on days. The 9-to-4 shift wasn't bad, but when the shift change rolled around to the 4-to-midnight, Osler had to fight to keep herself from falling in the dismals. It was one thing to trip home after midnight because you'd splashed out at the Café de Paris. It was quite another to fall into bed at 1 in the morning after a night spent making preparations for when the enemy invaded. There are plans to organise a mobile section of GC and CS, Miss Senyard told her girls, quite matter-of-factly. Those members of German naval section chosen will be supplied with special passports in preparation for hasty departure, so they can bunk off into the hills and keep up the fight once the Germans have taken over here, Osler thought with a sick twist of her stomach. Until now, she'd been able to contemplate her country's takeover in the abstract, a black cloud on the horizon. But to see practical preparations being made for the day German tanks came rolling through Bletchley Village. If Miss Senyard's announcement had come during day shift, Osler might have been able to toss her head in defiance. We will never need a mobile GC&CS to flee into the hills, because you'll never pull this invasion off, Herr Hitler. You'll have to run your tanks over my dead body and the dead bodies of everyone else in Britain first. But in the eerie, stuffy blackness of night, Miss Senyard's announcement and its implications seeped into Osler's bones like poison. If documents were being issued and orders passed down, it was fairly obvious Germany would be invading very soon. Dear Philip, if you stop getting my letters, at least we're not on night shifts yet, one of her fellow indexers yawned, noting Osler's long silence. The brainy boys work a midnight to nine shift too, because the Jerrys change all the cipher settings at midnight. I wonder how they do it. Break the ciphers. Osler wondered if she could learn to do it herself, get a transfer from filing and binding to something more taxing, something to keep her mind from the invasion. Not that one would ever ask. You just know Commander Denniston would have you dragged out behind the mansion and shot. But one can't help wondering. They must be fearfully clever fellows. Not only fellows. The answer surprised Osler. There's a whole clutch of girls in Knox's section, that little outbuilding by the stable block. The harem, they call it, because Knox only recruits women. Let me guess, they're all slap-up lookers and none over 20. Osler wasn't eager for that kind of transfer, much as she wanted more useful work. No, it's not like that. Hindley was raving a month ago how Knox poached a German-speaking girl he wanted for our section, a girl named Jane. Well, I've seen Jane, and she's got a bill like a duck. No one trying to stack his office with lookers would pick her. She's brainy, though. The brainy girls go to Dilly Knox. No idea what they do. That was the thing about the park. Gossip ran fluid as a river, but no one knew anything for certain. Midnight had descended black and cloudless as Osler yawned her way out of Hut 4. Codebreakers and linguists were fleeing for home and bed, as another stream of rumpled academics and girls in crepe frocks trudged in on the dreaded night shift, already looking absolutely knackered. If Mrs. F knocks on our door at 6 in the morning again, I'll pitch a fit, Mab grumbled, sauntering to join Osler. I need my beauty sleep tonight. I'm going for lunch with Andrew Kempton before tomorrow's shift. Is that the third man asking for a date, Queen Mab? Fourth. Mab didn't sound smug, just matter of fact. He was born in Whitstable, read German philosophy at Cambridge, no parents. Feel his withers and examine his teeth while you're at it. Are you taking a dead set at the delicious Harry Zarb, too? He's married, Mab said, regretful. At least he dropped that in right away. Most men only tell you they're married after trying to get a bit of the old, you know. Married? What a shame. You two would have had the world's tallest children. All the marriage talk made Osler think of the perennial spinster in the Finch household.
and the lurking desire for a project reappeared after the knight's horrified preoccupation with the German invasion.
We need to do something about Beth. The dread Mrs. Finch has her thoroughly nobbled. You can't help people if they won't help themselves. She won't even look us in the eye since the Literary Society meeting.
Osler was quite certain, after that night 2 weeks ago, that she'd seen bruises all over the inside of Beth's arm, the kind made by strong, pinching fingers targeting the sensitive skin inside the elbow, like a bird pecking at the tenderest part of a plum, introducing a little fizz and fun into Beth's life without putting her mother in a pucker. Now that was a project worth tackling. Osler and Mab were rounding the corner through Bletchley Village, walking down the centre of the road to avoid the muddy ruts on the verge, when a set of headlights reared behind them. Osler shrieked and leaped into a bush, and Mab staggered and fell into a deep rut. The car ground to a halt, the driver's door flying open.
Are you all right?
A man came round the bonnet, his shadowed shape hatless and stocky. By the flare of the car's headlights, he lifted Osler easily out of the bush.
I didn't see you till I rounded the bend.
Partly our fault, Osler said, getting her breath back. Mab! Stiffly, her friend picked herself up. Osler winced. Even in the indirect glare of the masked headlights, she could see that Mab's crisp cotton print was mud from collar to hem. Reaching down, Mab slipped her left shoe off and examined the snapped heel, and Osler saw her face crumple in the shadows. Every night she watched Mab polish those cheap shoes before bed, no matter how tired she was, to give them a Bond Street shine.
I'm sure we can fix it, Osler began, but Mab's crumpled expression vanished.
She drew back and hurled the broken shoes straight into the chest of the man who'd nearly run them off the road.
What are you doing taking a turn at that speed, you bloody bastard? She bellowed. Are you goddamned blind?
Clearly, the man said, barely catching the shoe.
He stood half a head shorter than Mab, a shock of russet hair falling over his forehead as he shaded his eyes to look at her.
My apologies.
We were walking in the middle of the road, Osler pointed out. But Mab stood on her one shod foot in the mud and let the stranger have it. He let it rain down, expression more admiring than horrified.
Blew your tire, Mab finished with a withering look. Guess you'll have to get down in the mud and change it out.
Would if I could, he replied. I'll just leave the car and head for the station. Are there any trains this late?
Mab folded her arms, cheeks still scarlet with indignation.
Easier to put the spare on if you've got a kit.
I haven't a clue how.
Mab slipped out of her other shoe, whizzed it into his hands, marched in her stocking feet through the mud to the car's boot, and held it open.
Have my shoes properly mended, and I'll change your ruddy tyre.
Deal.
He looked on, grinning, as Mab began yanking out tools.
How do you know how to change a blinking tyre? Osler wondered. I haven't the foggiest. A brother who works in a garage.
Mab rolled up her skirt at the waist to keep it out of the mud. Her flat stare promised the stranger slow, painful death if he ogled her legs.
Have you got a torch? Shine it over so I can see what I'm doing.
He deposited Mab's ruined shoes on the bonnet and switched on his torch, still grinning.
You two are BP workers.
Osler smiled politely, not answering that question on an open road.
Are you Mr.
Grey? And no, I'm in one of the London offices.
Intelligence, Osler thought, approving of his vagueness.
Or foreign office. I was running some information to Commander Denniston personally from my own boss. He was late getting me a reply, hence the midnight drive.
Osler offered a hand. He shook it over the beam of the torch.
Osler Kendall, that's Mab Chert cursing at your tyre. I'll need help winching up the car.
Mab's irate voice floated up.
Not you, Oz. No sense both of us ruining our stockings.
Osler watched as Mr. Grey lent a hand. He stayed to lug the spare through the dark and pass a few more tools, until Mab snapped.
You're in my way now. Just hold the torch.
Pity you don't work at BP instead of London, Mr. Grey, Osler said as he straightened. Hard to tell in the dark, but he looked 36 or 37, his face broad and calm and creased with smile lines. We need more fellows in our literary society.
Literary society?
He had a country voice, soft Midland vowels. He spoke to Osler, but he was watching Mab do something incredibly capable to the spare tyre.
I thought you BP girls were all maths and crosswords types.
Something niggled at the back of Osler's mind. Something about crosswords.
There.
Mab straightened, pushing her hair off her muddy cheek.
That should get you to London, Mr. Grey. Then you can get the other patched.
Her eyebrows lifted.
I'll expect my shoes back, good as new.
You have my word, Miss Chert.
He shouldered his blown tire so he could sling it into the boot.
I don't want to be found dead in a gutter.
Mab nodded grudgingly, turning to look at Osler.
Coming, Oz. You go,
Osler said as Mr. Grey nodded farewell in the dark and slipped back into his car. The bit about crosswords had dropped in her head with a click.
I've had an absolutely topping idea.
She hadn't been back inside the mansion since her first day. Even at midnight, it hummed like a beehive with exhausted men in their shirt sleeves. Osler couldn't get in to see Commander Denniston, but redhead Giles was in the conservatory, flirting with a typist, and Osler nipped her hand through his arm.
Giles, do you know if Denniston's still recruiting?
Crikey, yes. The rate traffic's mounting, they can't vet people fast enough.
I remember hearing something about crosswords.
There's a theory that crossword types, maths types, and chess-playing types are good at our sort of work. Personally, I think it's bollocks. I certainly can't tell a rook from a bishop.
Osler cut him off.
My landlady's daughter is an absolute whiz at crosswords.
That mousy little thing you brought to the shoulder of mutton. Are you mad, you dim-witted Deb?
Her name is Beth Finch, and don't call me that.
Osler remembered how fast Beth had finished the newspaper crossword at the pub.
Osler Kendall, not only are you not a dim-witted Deb, you are a genius.
Because maybe what Beth needed was a peroxide rinse, a new dress in the latest go, and a date with an airman or two. But she wasn't going to get any of those things if she never got out of the house. Even sitting behind a typewriter or binding signals on night shift had to be better than toiling for the dread Mrs. Finch until the Nazis came goose-stepping into Bletchley.
Take a puck, Giles, and put in a word with Denniston. Beth's going to fit right in at Bletchley Park.